Welcome to episode 104 of the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast on all platforms, including updating your other consoles so you can install a virtual game card. I'm Mark Uessa.
And I am Daniel Winter. Hello, Mark. Welcome back to our regularly scheduled program.
That's right. It's been our first regular episode in quite some time since we had a four special episode spree, which some of you probably heard. So let's just roll into the regular programming.
Yeah. Well, just quickly, I guess, since we are dealing with a relatively new format, and for anyone new who may have joined us, we generally have three segments for each episode. We have the appetizer where we discuss some news and other sort of game ephemera, maybe some shorter games that we'd like to discuss. The main course where we each pick one larger game to discuss in detail, and then the dessert where we pick something non-game related that we've each been enjoying. So with that said, I guess we should jump into the appetizer. Lots to cover today.
Yeah, there's been a decent amount of news since we last spoke about it a month ago.
And unfortunately, it's all bummers.
Pretty much. Why don't you start us off?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, to cover the elephant in the room here, the big one is the constant, barrage of tariff news, basically, that has changed many times and will likely have again by the time this episode goes live. Literally just the last hour, there's news of movies are being tariffed now. So, I mean, it's hard to cover this with any explicit details other than some of the general overviews of what this impact is going to be, because even irregardless of the exact tariff amount and how strictly it's being enforced, just the uncertainty, I think, is just as much of an impact on the industry. I mean, most industries, but board games especially, and TTRPGs. But I think board games is being hit hardest of the sort of Omnigamer spectrum here, with like large physical retail presence. Right. And we've already seen several publishers close entirely or cut a lot of staff members. And yeah, I mean, it's rough out there right now. Board games especially have always been a very tight margin. Many smaller publishers run, shall we say, with passion rather than, you know, strong business sense, for better or worse. And yeah, it's going to have a drastic hit on so much of the creativity and livelihoods going into the hobby.
The tariff talk affects so many industries. There are entire tip-top game companies, particularly the ones based out of the United States, mm-hmm. and or role-playing studios putting out books that are printed in China, or independent toy sellers, independent toy and board game publishers, board game retailers that are going to have a hard time selling these more luxury products in a time when people are having to tighten their wallets and their belts. So it's hard all around, not to mention new consoles are coming out. Those are going to be more expensive.
True.
Even existing consoles are getting more expensive, as we'll discuss later. Then there's the retro consoles as well, which largely work on zero razor thin profit margin. So it covers so many different things. I don't want to delve too deep into it. Not that it doesn't affect us deeply, but because it affects so many areas so deeply that I feel like I can't talk about it
barely scratch the surface,
expertly.
Yeah. I mean, there has been some excellent reporting from Board Game Wire, Rascal News, various other sources. Go check those out. But unfortunately, like in related news, we've had the closure of Polygon has essentially been gutted, which is one of the few sort of online media outlets that were covering tabletop games in addition to video games. It was one of the few sort of websites that was reaching a wider audience rather than the niche hobbyist board gaming group that's already quite sort of limited. So, I mean, there's you know, one less media outlet covering games broadly, and it does feel like there's been an ongoing effort to basically kill the art of games journalism broadly, unfortunately, which makes it much harder to cover this. I mean, there are those excellent sort of independent outlets out there now, but it takes resources, institutional knowledge, more manpower to cover these topics meaningfully, right? And these smaller outlets are doing a great effort, but it's a shame to see these long-time institutions closing shop.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, this is just a continuation of lots of bummer news, like, you know, the last significant video game magazine, like Game Informer, shutting down as well. That was not too long ago. So I feel like I can't speak about those publication closures too much either, because it is another one of those massive topics. I am heartened to see more independent news flourish these days, definitely in our circles, like the outfits that you mentioned, but not all news can become independent news. It's just too important for this to be a cottage industry, right? This has to be well supported by many people, because this affects all of us.
Especially when there's so much news to cover.
It's true. Yeah. So on that thread, let's keep talking about more topics, more important topics. I mentioned that prices are going up. So why don't we talk a little bit about that? Microsoft has announced that there'll be price hikes for their existing consoles, like the Xbox Series S and X. The S is up $80 US. The X is up $100 US. That's just following price increases for Sony PS5 not that long ago. And then they just had another price hike in some regions that you might be familiar with, like Australia and New Zealand. Daniel, of course, the Nintendo Switch 2 announced that they will be raising the prices on certain accessories. But I think that they may have baked in the price somewhat when they announced the price of the Switch 2 recently.
That was a fairly conservative price, I think, from the get-go. It was already quite high. Yeah.
That's right.
This is pretty unprecedented. Like, generally, just about every console generation has gone down in price over the course of the generations, right? And then they'll release the Pro model to basically increase the price later on, but for an upgraded model. This is the first time they've increased the price, at least as far as I can remember, of an existing model. It's uncertain times.
More and more I'm wondering, you know, are consoles going to be a thing? There was already a lot of doubt with a lot of Microsoft's movements, which are arguably, you know, pro-consumer, to allow people to play on different platforms, including TVs and TV sticks and that sort of thing. Cloud-based is not new. Sony has cloud-based platforms as well. So arguably those alternatives are not a bad thing, but I know that so many people still love a console, including myself, knowing that if you buy a game, it'll just run, it'll work beautifully, depending on the specs of the system. So I, for one, don't want consoles to go away, but this is a turning point. This is an inflection point for consoles, like life or death, basically.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there's pros and cons. Obviously, cloud gaming, I mean, there's, apart from the fact that internet service is not a guarantee across the world, even here in Canada, it's not guaranteed, let alone in other areas of the world. And again, it's, I guess, a shift towards that trend of not actually owning games. You're buying licenses, temporary licenses to play temporarily. Game Pass has already shifted in that direction, along with various other sort of games as service models. So yeah, it's going to be a very interesting time to see how this develops over the next couple of years. I think regardless of what the original intentions of these gaming companies were, things are being accelerated and pushed in a particular direction, partly against their will, but this is also accelerating plans they already had in place, I guess.
Yeah. A couple more pieces of bummer news, and I want to get through them fairly quickly because I don't want to be frowns all around. But Microsoft, this is a piece of news that sort of came up a little while ago, and we haven't talked about it at length, is there's a movement, the BDS movement, to boycott Microsoft and thus Xbox-related products due to their connection to software that the Israeli government is using to target individuals in their war on Palestine. I think it's significant. Of course, it's always up to the individual to determine what's the right choice for them. Because if we divested from all jerks and people connected to bad products or services or investors, then we would basically use nothing. But I just wanted to put out there that I, for one, have canceled my Xbox Game Pass account. I just happen to know, for my own sake, I have plenty of games that I have.
We all have a big Steam backlog, right?
Exactly. We all have our personal Steam backlogs. I borrow games from the library. I have games I already bought. I will be just fine without using Game Pass for however long it takes, till hopefully the war on Palestine can be ended really soon.
Yeah, I mean, this is a tough situation. I mean, not to say that, you know, our enjoyment of games seems so shallow in comparison to some of the atrocities we're seeing across the world right now. And I mean, obviously, we are both fairly invested in Microsoft, in Game Pass, especially as in our roles as critics, for lack of a better term. We want to be responsible and you know, make our values clear, be true to those values. It's easy to feel powerless with all of these atrocities across the world. Hard to know what you can do to make a difference. And this is one small thing. You can be part of a larger cause, be responsible for your own actions, and be more intentional about what you're playing, about the companies you're supporting. If you want to be upset about this, be upset at the fact that so many, like such a huge umbrella of games at the moment, are controlled by this shrinking group of mega corporations.
Right.
I mean, Disney as well is also targeted as part of the same BDS movement. Various other media conglomerates are included there. So, yeah.
And for us living here in Canada, and of course, basically anywhere outside of the United States, there's movements to boycott products coming out of America, to de-Trumpify our media content as well. So that's another layer of considerations that we need to make as well. And this is just part of that. So, I'll say that I'm not going to sneer at anyone if they continue their using Game Pass or other products. That's not my job. You know, I'm just saying that, just announcing it here, just so we may not be covering the latest Game Pass game.
And we want to help others make an informed decision. This is our position, and encourage others to at least look into more information. Aftermath, the video game website, has some excellent reporting on this. I'd recommend people to go and check that out. I'll drop some links in the notes.
Yeah. Okay. A couple tiny pieces of news. I'm not going to editorialize. I'm just going to mention them. Then one piece of good news. Okay. Virtual game cards are out. They're not fun. And it closes this loophole that some point allowed multiple family members, for instance, to use one digital license. That license has since been closed. There's plenty of good reporting out there to learn more about this closed loophole. There's a change in the eShop algorithm at Nintendo eShop, essentially, to deprioritize some indie games. And I know the reasoning behind this is that there's a lot of shovelware on that platform in particular, a lot of zero cost or one penny 99% games.
99% off.
Right. Yep. A lot of AI slop that's out there. So I get it, but that's essentially going to prop up Nintendo first party games and popular games at the expense of smaller ones. I already mentioned the Sony price hike. Remember, essentially, we're equal opportunity console haters here, or not haters at all. Basically, none of these corporations are your friends.
No.
And none of them is more ethical than the other. We're all victims in a console war.
Yeah, I mean, all of these news pieces have me thinking about like what our roles are, both as consumers of these games, but also as critics and advocates for these games. Like, what is our role in talking about this? We obviously want to see these publishers and gaming companies succeed and still exist, but we're also not there to serve them and to sell games for them. So it has given me a lot of thought as to how we want to frame talking about these games, perhaps highlighting games that wouldn't otherwise get some attention, but also being mindful of not just there to be a buyer's guide, right? We still want to talk about the art as an art piece.
Right. And for me, I'm just going to end it with one positive piece of news. It's a little positive, but anything helps, is that I read that the Epic Game Store is completely eliminating their revenue fees for some smaller developers. So, of course, platforms like the App Store, Steam, charge Xbox, whatever, what have you, charge typically 30%, I believe, cut off of every, you know, dollar spent, essentially. And now that they're completely eliminating those fees for smaller devs up to a certain point, I would imagine. I don't know. I haven't read the full bottom line, but I think that's a positive news and gives those smaller indie shops a leg up for while they're trying to get a game up off the ground or start their small business. So I applaud that effort.
Yeah, today's news in The Worst Person You Know said something you agree with. Epic, not exactly a company to root for either.
Right, yeah. You got to look at the small silver lining where you can. And with that, my bummer news is over.
Yes, yeah, hopefully by next week we might have some better news to talk about. But I feel it would be a little irresponsible to not talk about at least some of these big topics that have been brewing over the last month or so.
Right, shall we delve into happier territory then?
Yes, yeah, let's jump into the main course. So, with all that said, my main course today, my game that I'm bringing is Zaya, Legends of the Drift System. So this is a board game, to be clear. I think perhaps sometimes we're not clear as to where a game falls in this spectrum. So this is designed by Cody Miller. Art also by Cody Miller, by Steve Coolhand Tyler and Peter Walken, published by Far Off Games in 2013. So recently in our top 100 games list, you know, spoiler for those who haven't already listened, I spoke about Merchant of Venus, a longtime favorite game of mine. And I've long been searching for a sort of more modern successor to that sandbox space exploration game. It has a little bit of everything, something to explore, to do some space trucking, basically. Scratch that itch again. I've had Zaya on my shelf of shame for a few years, and revisiting Merchant of Venus recently, I thought, you know, good opportunity to pull that off and compare it directly. So I guess I should describe this game. It is very much a sci-fi sandbox game. You've got various tiles, large sort of chunky tiles that you're going to be interlocking with each other to create this sort of galaxy map bit by bit. It starts with a small, like only one tile per player, and then you're gradually creating more. So it's going to be a somewhat randomized layout of the galaxy every game. You've got these excellent little pre-painted ships. There's like at least 20 ships in the base game, all pre-painted with a, you know, pretty good job, to be honest. There's a very evocative sense of unique individuality with all these ships, metal coins, really great spread. In terms of playing the game, it is basically a race to points. You set a threshold of points, either 10 or 20, depending on how long you want the game to go. And then there's about 10 different ways you can get points and just, you know, fly off any direction, see what you want to do. You can get points from buying new ships, buying a bigger ship. You can get points from picking up goods and delivering it. That old chestnut. You can get goods from going to explore token. Most of the new tiles that are revealed will have an explore token that may give you some points. You can get them from missions. There are mission cards that will range from, you know, simple research, go to this place, take the research material to this other place, to assassin missions where you have to kill another ship, whether it's a player or an NPC. There's basically passenger missions, escort missions, a wide variety of mission types there. You can just spend money. Like if you earn enough money, you can just play that to get a point. If you ever roll a d20, you're rolling a bunch of different dice sizes in this game, but if you ever roll a d20 and you get a 20, you just get a point. As constituting fame, basically. It's taking some really interesting lessons from role-playing games that I'll get to in that regard. I feel like I'm forgetting at least one more. What else was there? Oh, titles, yes. Basically, at certain points of the game, there'll be revealed these titles that are basically shared goals. It might say something like, first person to give someone else 2,000 credits, or the first person to basically tow someone back to a planet, because that's another way you can get points is literally called kindness. If someone gets stranded, you can go and give them some energy to help them get back to civilization. So wide variety of options there as to how you can get points, and most of the time you're going to be doing a little bit of each and dabbling here and there. So where do I start? It's just like this pretty sprawling game, a lot of different systems to engage with. It's pretty quick to set up, similar to how we discussed in Eclipse. You can set up the game in 5 to 10 minutes. There are quite a lot of systems to teach. The rule book isn't particularly well laid out in that regard, but you can at least do a rolling teach where you can get the basics from the start, and then as each new tile is revealed, it might add a new mechanic. So you don't necessarily have to cover everything at the outset. So
well, maybe you can, you know, we did have the... We did have the Eclipse talk the other day, a pretty extensive one. We covered it in a full episode. So maybe you can kind of compare and contrast. Like, it doesn't sound like it's an exact clone of the 4X nature of Eclipse. You know, how does it differ?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about Eclipse as well in terms of how it was managing a lot of different systems and synthesizing those as a 4X game, but it was doing exploration and ship combat and research engine building. This similarly is integrating a lot of different systems, but I don't know that it does it quite as successfully in terms of integrating everything. You do have some light engine building in your ships, because each ship has a unique power. And all of those are pretty unique. They all feel pretty powerful. And when you upgrade to a new ship, you actually keep your old ship power. So you can actually, by the end of the game, you have up to three different ship powers sort of interacting in a unique way. Most of the rest of the game, though, is going to be very chaotic. It's hard to actually plan ahead much of what you're doing here in terms of how you're strategizing. Most ships don't really specialize in any one thing, or they might let you do something slightly better, but it's not like you're committing to one type of gameplay. You don't really commit to, I'm just going to do pick up and deliver. I'm just going to go and do some missions. I'm just going to be really aggressive. Largely, you have to be opportunistic here and just do a little bit of everything, see what comes up, see what the dice say, and just be willing to roll with it, be willing to pivot entirely. And that, I think, is partly some of my issues here, in that it's the game that understands the power of a good story, in that, like I said, when you're rolling a d20, you automatically get a point. It encourages you to make a story. Why did I just get a point for doing this thing? Rolling a d20 in D&D, you do something really well. How does that fit into the emergent storytelling here? There's a lot of emergent story in how the tiles come out, how certain planets being next to each other, and certain the NPCs or NPC ships that are moving around and doing their own thing, and how they interact with each other and with the players can lead to some excellent emergent storytelling. Or even like there's a sun, it's one big sun tile. If you happen to fly into it, you die instantly. Of course, there is an option to jump to when you're exploring. You can do something called a blind jump, where you move into a tile before you know what it's going to be. Inevitably, someone is going to fly into the sun. And hey, it creates a hell of a story. the problem is, it understands the power of that story, but it doesn't really utilize that in a balanced way. Ultimately, the game is about just getting points, and the way you go about getting those points isn't always the most interesting way of engaging with the game. It's going to be finding like one loop of goods that you can deliver back and forth and just repeating that ad nauseum. Or it's going to be just getting really lucky. Like one of the most reliable strategies here seems to be just take your chances as much as you can, roll as many dice as you can, and don't fail at rolling those dice. Because a lot of everything you do in this game, you're rolling dice. To mine asteroids, you roll a dice. You might take damage if you fail. To mine salvage, on a 1 to 3, your ship blows up instantly, and you might miss a turn, or you either way you respawn the next turn, you lose everything in your hold. So everything you do, there's quite an explicit risk to it in this game. But if you play it safe, you're probably not going to win either. So the victory is ultimately going to go down to who's lucky, essentially. And I know it's just really hard to feel like you're directing yourself in a role-playing sense, like having an identity. Oh, this is the ship I've got. I'm going to focus on this one element of the game. You're probably not going to do very well. You want to just be pivoting and doing a little bit of everything and just get lucky, essentially. So it's a little tricky in that regard. The mission types, that's one of the things I enjoyed the most, was the missions, because there's a wide variety there. But at least in the base game, you can only have one mission at a time. And there's quite a lot of luck as to what you can do with those missions. Each of them will have basically a pickup point and a drop-off point. They could be at complete opposite ends of the map. They could be right next to each other. And it very rarely felt worthwhile, even when there was a slight... usually you're rolling a dice to see what your reward is for that as well. So again, another degree of the RNG there. It makes it tough to sort of really play consistently with those missions. I know. I feel like, to be honest, this game really needed to focus on one element or another it just feels a little too unfocused. And like Merchants of Venus, for example, had a lot of different things going on, but primarily was a pick up and deliver game. Whereas this is doing a little bit of this, a little bit of that. No one system is particularly deep or engaging. You just have to try and do a little bit of everything and hope you get lucky. And so in that regard, I don't know. There's something to this game. There is something incredibly compelling as just a beer and pretzels, fly around, see what happens, maybe try and lean into the role-playing element of it. But the actual victory conditions of the game feel constantly at odds with that in terms of trying to engage with the fun elements of the game, not going to be particularly successful usually.
Yeah, the reason why the pattern of 4X games is so popular and tried and true is because there's four ways, roughly, to win, right? There's not 7 or 12 ways to win. Four is pretty much like a decent way to start. You know, people can handle within levels of complexity probably 5 to 7 things, but four is really nice to get people, players, to focus. Sometimes the game design can feel a little bit bloated by being a little point salad-y. I'm not saying Zaya is, I haven't played it myself, but you know, like, there's a reason why fewer kind of avenues towards success is not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, I mean, most of those games have a degree of like engine building or economy or some sort of tight, balanced mechanic that you're engaging with. This is very much emergent storytelling as a means of getting points, or just, yeah, roll to see what happens and maybe you'll get some points. And for, it's a long game too. Like we tried to play a 20 point game last night. We had 4 players. We got 4 hours in and the max someone had was 11 points. So we're halfway there. So it's quite slow going, especially with 4 players, because there's a lot of new information revealed every turn. Like if someone's exploring, or there's a new tile which has completely changed the sort of the calculations of what's valuable, or they might be rolling to harvest or mine, or picking up mission cards and looking at those. Everything takes time to consider what your options are, because there's so many options in this game, especially if you're trying to play optimally. So yeah, what this game really had me thinking about though is just the victory conditions and how I'd love to see games play with that, play with how we define victory in a different way, because here it's just an arbitrary get points, have the most points. But if, I mean, there's been a trend towards some designers exploring multi-victor games, whether one person wins more than others, but even Dead of Winter was doing that with like people win to differing degrees and allowing players to define their own sense of victory or have their own goals, perhaps, rather than just do a little bit of everything. Maybe you could have specific player goals or goals tied to your specific ship that you allow you to get points in particular ways. Just have a stronger sense of identity and ownership about who you are in this world and what you're trying to do. Because that's the thing, whenever you win, you're supposed to flip over your ship and there's a victory story on the ship. And there's like this like long paragraph story about who your character is and what they're doing now. But like that's completely arbitrary based on what you did to win, what your previous ships were. It's always going to be the same for that ship, basically. So it wants to be a role-playing game and have that story, but I just feel like the victory is really at odds with that, unfortunately. And I do know this publisher, Far Off Games, has lent more towards that role-playing element with their latest game, Aridia, which is like a cooperative fantasy storytelling, it's a dungeon crawling game, I believe, which and that has this whole like card-based system where characters are reading out responses. It seems to be leaning into that more, and they definitely want to be playing with that intersection of role-playing and board game. I don't think it entirely nails it here, unfortunately.
You think you'll keep playing Zaya?
I would like to. There is the expansion. Most people I've spoken to have said the expansion is basically mandatory. We did play that last night. It does fix a few things. Like it changes the pick up and deliver, basically, to create a supply and demand system, which limits how many types of each resource are available. So you can't just ferry one type back and forth ad nauseum. It does then in the process create more upkeep and fiddliness, and then just leads to people not really engaging with that system at all. But it also added events, and these events were wildly swingy. Like the first event that came out basically said, it basically created wormholes across the map so that every tile was equidistant from each other. So suddenly distance across the map was irrelevant and people were just teleporting every which way. That's just sort of destroyed any sense of sort of balance or sort of space. The next one was called like space socialism or something, and basically was a catch-up mechanic where everyone behind the leader got a little bit of extra money or energy at the start of each turn, which is interesting in theory, but is not balanced with the rest of the game that was designed, right? So it's going to be a completely different game every time. I'd probably leave out those events unless you've played the game a bunch and just need more stuff happening. But really, there was just... It balanced out some things, but it didn't really fix that fundamental issue I've had with how you judge the victory in this game. I think it's still very much a chaos simulator. There's going to be a stuff pinging off. It does feel like an excellent simulated space of you've got the NPCs moving around, you've got the new boards coming out, and like you see the galaxy spread. There's this huge sprawling map of tiles. You do have this really interesting emergent storytelling of how this galaxy is laid out and the stories you're telling within it. It's just then it comes time to actually trying to win the game, and that wasn't particularly interesting, I found.
Yeah, starfaring space, you know, conquering games are kind of hard because there's so many of them, and so many of them are already good. So you kind of have to ask, like, what is the new system, Zaya or whatnot, really adding to the mix? Those event cards you're mentioning there just remind me a little bit of like Cosmic Encounter, which has been around for decades and decades, and is a nice chaotic space themed games. Of course, we already talked about both editions of Eclipse. The big dog, the 800 pound gorilla, is of course Twilight Imperium, which has been around for many years as well and has had multiple different editions. Just to mention a few, you kind of have to ask yourself, do we need another one of those? I guess everyone feels like they can bring their own spin on it. I don't know if what you're describing sounds terribly exciting or new.
Yeah, I mentioned, I spoke about Merchant of Venus. Now, it had two different modes. There was the classic mode, which was more of an economic game, and then there was the standard mode, which it feels very much in conversation with Zaya, and just being lots of event cards coming up, lots of random things happening, rolling dice constantly, just really random chaos simulator, which is fun to see stuff happen, but not particularly compelling over a 4-hour experience. You want something a little more consistent and paced and balanced for that. You can still have the emergent storytelling, but you just need to have a better sense of direction and a goal, I think, to direct yourself in this sort of game if you're going to be invested in that long of a time period. There are some really good core elements, like the action system in Zaya. You basically got these four little action cubes or tokens that you can use to activate either your movement or your weapons or your shield, and you have to make the decision, like, are you going to move four times or are you going to spend some time in combat or defending yourself? But at the same time, combat felt really underbaked here, in that you either have to go all in and have like your entire ship decked out with guns. Otherwise, there's not really any point engaging with the combat system. You're probably just going to do two damage to their ship, and then someone else is going to come in and steal your kill, basically. So, it's a bunch of different systems that are just really at odds with each other, unfortunately.
A lot of point salad games are. All right, should we talk about our next game?
Absolutely. What have you got for us today?
All right. So the game I have to talk about is a tabletop role-playing game. We haven't talked about one of those in a little while. This one is called DCC, which is short for Dungeon Crawl Classics. So DCC is an OSR, or old school revival style role-playing game, played on the tabletop by Joseph Goodman. The original edition was designed by Joseph Goodman of Goodman Games. And the theory behind OSR games is that they're essentially trying to harken back to the olden days of the 1970s and early 80s. RPGs, essentially, you know, your D&D before AD&D, your first edition, before everything became much, much more complicated. Essentially old school, kind of rudimentary, and kind of a little bit schlocky, a little bit pulpy. Not so much the emoting and dramaturgy for theater kids and streamers like a lot of the modern day 5e crowd goes for. just a little bit more old school, let's just say. And I played another OSR system called, what was that one called? Old School Essentials. Mm. Got to play that at the previous TCTC, not the last one, but the one before. And this one compared pretty, you know, pretty closely. If you, you know, don't look terribly deeply at the specifics, they carry the same, you know, kind of feeling, which is like the retro style gaming. Both games, Old School Essential and DCC, have this thing called the funnel. So this is quite new to me, but maybe they did this back in the day, if you're more experienced with the early editions of those games. Basically, you start with a very a number, and in DCC, it started with 4 level 0 characters. So these characters are so basic. Essentially, if you know your level 1 adventurers are kind of like heroes on a quest, level 0 characters are like villagers in a village. Like, they are not heroes. They are things like weavers or blacksmiths or cleaners or just very basic, simple, mundane roles. And they might have equipment like a pitchfork, or they might have a soup pot lid for armor. So don't expect a lot from these characters. Basically, they're sent into this sort of a gauntlet adventure. And if they survive, then they have the privilege of leveling up into level 1, at which point they're true heroes on their journey. And there you go. And that was unique and very fun if you haven't done before. Essentially, my Old School Essentials experience at TCTC that one year was just that.
How much upkeep is it, though, controlling that many characters at once? Or do you even have agency over what you're doing with each of these 4 different characters?
Well, you don't get agency in how the characters are created. They're created, in fact, quite randomly. So basically, every aspect of them, and I have a sheet showing that there's like a 4-up sheet on one letter-sized piece of paper here. Essentially, each character is like an index card size, as opposed to like the 3 full letter size sheets that even a level 1 5e character could be. 5e, D&D 5e, that is. So they basically have the 6 basic stats. They have an armor class and a hit point. They have an alignment, of which there is only 3, lawful, neutral, or chaotic. They have an occupation, which is like their kind of mundane role before they started, and then they have like, I don't think you even have skills. At least I've never seen a list of skills when I've played. Even my level 1 characters, I haven't seen yet. They might have very, very basic equipment. So in a sense, it's not a lot of overhead to control 4 characters because they're not that different. They're not that complex. It's kind of probably less complex than running a squad in a game like XCOM or something like that, because there's less information to deal with. So you can roll these up really quickly. In fact, on various online resources, you can just press one button and you get 4 level 0 characters instantly spat out on a sheet of paper. And that's essentially what I have here printed out. I had all the stats filled out. So it couldn't be easier.
Think it is engaging, like, running the 4 through the gauntlet and seeing who wins rather than just, say, rolling a dice to see which one survives?
It is engaging, sort of like the way that a science experiment with rats in a maze might be interesting, right? Like, you don't feel a lot of ownership to them because your 4 random characters are not that different from your neighbor's 4 random characters.
Perhaps seeing one survive against the odds is part of the charm there, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. There's that sort of scientific belief, right, that something that you created yourself has more inherent value than something that you were just given. So maybe seeing this thing, this character that you were given, seeing them through the gauntlet like that funnel makes you feel a little bit of a sense of ownership to them. I think that your mileage may vary, and I'll tell you how I felt about it kind of at the end of my talk. So a few other things that sets this game apart from D&D is that it includes the kind of the regular standard D&D polyhedral dice, but it includes quite a bit more of these special dice that are quite rare, called Zocchi dice in some circles. And this includes things like D3s, D5s, D7s, 14, 16, 24, a 30-sided die. So if you want to play, you know, the proper way with a full set, you're going to have to seek out these DCC-specific dice or a set of Zachi dice from your hobby shop or order them online. Essentially just, you know, the GM, my neighbor Paul, has a couple of sets and we share them at the table. So that's on top of your regular, somewhat already rarer dice, the standard 5e ones. So that's gonna make it a little bit harder for people that don't have access to those particular tools. But thankfully, there are apps and online dice rollers if you just want to try it out. Also, if you do want to just try it out, go to seek out Goodman Games online. There's a free, I think, 30-page starter set. So you can go check out the art right now. It's quite nice, actually, full color front and back, and then black and white art in the insides. It's like very old school layout, very reminiscent of even the 80s RPG books I would read. So just kind of gets you in the mood for that old school stuff. Okay, aside from that, it's very much just like kind of D&D. Right? You got elves and dwarves. Like old school D&D, elves and dwarves act like character classes. So you don't have a dwarven cleric. You have a dwarf. And a dwarf is a dwarf. And so when you have a dwarf, you level up that character like it was a class. And then you have other classes like clerics and warriors, of course. And like I said, all your stats were rolled up randomly, so you don't have a lot of control over your character. In modern D&D, you know, a lot of people spend quite a bit of time kind of crafting their character into something unique, their special little baby, their OC, or original character, as they call it. They might create a backstory, they might create character art. And of course, you can create character art for this, but your character might not last very long, because this game is very lethal. So for instance, HP is rolled randomly. So for instance, I rolled, one of my characters had 1 HP to start. So if they got hit by anything, they would die. If they got bit by a mouse, they would die. If they got kissed by a bat, they would die. If they got slapped by a tentacle plant, they would die. And then when I leveled up to level 1, I rolled a die to add my additional HP, and I rolled a 1. So my level 1 character had 2 HP, which was less than a lot of other level 0 characters others had rolled. So that was a little bit hard pill to swallow. And, you know, because all the characters are rolled randomly, just kind of there's not that close sense of ownership to them in general. They're just kind of like a mishmash. Kind of like if you rolled randomly in a video game RPG, you know, just rolled the dice and took whatever they gave you.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you're just going on stats, right? I mean, I've played a couple of OCR games recently, like Mothership, and I've really enjoyed those. Like, I prefer where I'm discovering a character, rolling to see who they are, rather than creating a character, you know, in my image.
Interesting.
But even like Mothership, you have a random flare patch, for example, which or it's something else. You get a couple of things that suggest a degree of personality or behavior.
Yeah.
Where if it's just you have a sword and you have 2 HP, like there's not much to hang on there, right?
I like that aspect of Mothership, and I saw that chapter as well, where you get like a tagline, like a motto or something that you might say. For instance, in this game, you have on top of all those other things I mentioned, you have a lucky sign. Okay. So that's kind of like your, like in Morrowind or Elder Scrolls games, when you were born under a star sign and you get special treatment, like the bull, your melee attack rolls are better, or, you know, you're conceived on horseback, your mounted horse attacks are better. Beyond that, you don't have a lot, actually. The characters are pretty much just bags of stats, as I like to call them. So that part is a bit of a bummer for those former drama kids that want to, you know, emote or watch their character develop. Other things that are a bit different is that because everyone controls upwards of four characters, kind of determining and managing initiative is quite a chore.
Mm.
So for those that don't play a lot of TTRPGs, basically every player typically rolls dice to determine what order they will act within a sequence, and then the monsters and foes will roll typically as well, and then you kind of get slotted in an order. And when you have five players at the table and a couple of different types of monsters, that's kind of like seven slots, right? If you have five players times four characters, that's 20 characters.
So how does this even work in visualizing the battlefield? Do you have, is it actually like on a gridded map, or is it all theater of the mind?
We play mostly in person, and then we have one person zooming in, essentially.
Mm.
So we mostly play theater of the mind.
Okay.
Although in the past, when we've played D&D, we've had gridded maps as well. But this one, it's quite unwieldy. You could imagine having like 30 miniatures on a gridded map, and it would just be like gridlock.
If 20 like, people are trying to hit the same goblin, I mean, it's going to be chaos, and they're going to end up stabbing each other more often than not.
Well, you'd set up that battle, right, and put your 30 or 40 miniatures on the map, and then the battle might be over by the time it gets to the fourth player, right? Because eight characters have acted or something like that. So it was quite a headache for, typically we have one person managing the initiative and then managing it by your character name. You might not remember your character name if it was called out since you have four of them. So there's a lot of waiting. There's a lot of managing. There's a lot of overhead. And I know there's alternatives to that. Of course, you could just do it per player and then they could just take four moves with all of their characters at once. That said, you're not guaranteed that the last player will get to act either. So that's a bit of a headache as well. And because of the nature that you're controlling multiple characters as well, not only did you not have a chance to kind of craft them in the way that you want to, you sort of lose the sense of ownership in role-playing as well.
Mm.
So when a situation happens and the prince of the land says, I need you to go kill the goblins in the ancient cathedral or something like that, when you're saying, okay, we'll do it, which of your characters is saying that? Like, why would you choose one over the other? Maybe the one with more personality, but then, you know, do you put on a character voice for that one character? Does he have a character? You kind of have a lot of these more like logistical questions come up. And I'm a player that kind of wants to emote and kind of wants to develop character. Not everyone is. Totally fine. But I just have to ask myself, what is the relationship between my characters, let alone between my characters and the other players' characters? If they're not emoting and they're running kind of four pawns on a map, well, what am I even doing here? I'm just kind of like one in a crowd, you know? So you might be getting a sense from me that I have a bit of negative opinion about this system. It's not entirely bad. I mean, it's kind of pretty fun in a simplistic way. It feels a lot more like a board game, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, old school D&D was very much just the mechanics, right? The actual character role-playing was an afterthought.
Right. And there's some certain like niceness to not know what's going to come up, you know, even in a game like Pandemic. You know, Pandemic has those kind of character roles, right? They're like, you're the logistics guy and you can move one more time, or you're like the researcher or something. It gives you a little hook to give you a sense of a player style, but you still don't get like new scenarios per se. Maybe you do in Legacy, in Pandemic Legacy or whatnot, but in a TTRPG, of course, the GM, the DM can really elaborate and tell their own story if they want to, or they could let it roll on the dice. So another thing that is unique about DCC is that it relies on a lot of random tables. So in that sense, like, there's good and bad that comes with that too, right? Like, it's exciting because when you roll a 20, like we talked about with Zaya, it's not just that you get double damage or whatever. Like you actually have to roll another die on a random table, and then one of 20 different outcomes will happen. And similarly, if we roll a 1, you roll on a table, and then one of multiple bad things can happen as well. You roll different dies, roll on a table when you get a certain outcome to a spell. So when you roll like an attack spell or something, and it's not just that the attack spell worked or it didn't work, it's like you have different degrees of how it worked or not. Or I mentioned the lethality of this system. You might get a sort of blowback, as in if it didn't work, there might be multiple bad things that happen to you in addition to you just losing that spell slot. So that part of it is exciting too.
There's some interesting analogs here in terms of games as these sort of chaos simulators, and rolling dice, random things happening can be very exciting. But it's only when you can infuse that with meaning and everyone's engaged with it, rather than you roll the dice and either you die or you get a point, right? When right. It's reduced entirely to mechanical, like success failure, it's not particularly exciting.
Yeah. So I think there's lots of good in DCC, obviously. It's very, very popular. For instance, they say, I read on the Goodman Games website that it's the second most popular TTRPG on Kickstarters. So considering how popular other systems like Mothership are, DCC must be more popular than that, because of course the most popular system is 5e. So that's good for them. They have hundreds of supplements. Like, you will just not run out of material.
If you just need content, sure, that's there.
Yeah, and they've actually republished some old out of copyright material because it's roughly compatible with current DCC rules. So it's very easy to put out material. Goodman Games is very friendly to indies that want to put out compatible content. And I should mention also that Goodman Games puts out DCC, Dungeon Crawl Classics, which is the typical kind of D&D trad style fantasy. They also put out MCC, which is Mutant Crawl Classics, which is kind of more like Gamma World. So it's sort of post-apocalyptic mutants and kind of monsters and giant bugs sort of thing. So that's kind of cool. And their latest spinoff is X-Crawl Classics, which is a kind of like a brutal game show kind of theme. Like, so everyone's kind of like on a televised death game, and you're televised running through a gauntlet.
Interesting, because I was thinking this, some of the that gauntlet element sounds like a lot like Takeshi's Castle or some of those game shows.
Exactly. So there's lots of interesting things going on there. I'll just say that if you want to kind of emote and develop a deep character, it might take quite a while, and you might not have nearly as much kind of precise control as to what character you get to play, because you don't know who's going to survive. And I think they say that once your character's like, once you have like level one plus characters, you don't like reroll three more characters or two more characters anymore. Eventually you kind of settle down on your one or two characters that are more higher level. And if you do have one higher level character and multiple lower level characters, you can kind of treat the lower level characters as their like assistants or squires, minions or something like that.
Yeah,
exactly. So they're sort of there and ready to swoop in when eventually your primary character dies off. Because
imagine this diminishing returns on how much you can draw out of like the fifth farm boy, right? Like all these farm boys are the same after a point.
Yeah, but maybe it's a farm boy from a different village or something like that that you picked up along the way. So yeah, there's definitely good and not so great for some players, but you probably know who you are if you like more kind of randomness and see how it goes, or more of a beer and pretzels type game, or more of an old school game. I think this is a great setting. Another good thing is that the game is quite inexpensive to get into, aside from those dice. I think the paperback version of the main book can be had for like $35 Canadian, which is pretty inexpensive. And I think the hardcover, it's good that they even offer two options, a paperback and a hardcover. The hardcover is not much more. I think it's more like 50 Canadian or something like that. It's readily available. And the supplements are really cheap too. They come out on like 20, 30 pages, just on nice black and white crisp paper stock. And there's so much content out there. And a lot of it is free. A lot of it is given away on free RPG days or on Humble Bundles, things like that. So very, very accessible stuff.
Yeah, in terms of pure accessibility, this is definitely a good option. In terms of, like, I've spoken before about how much I have performance anxiety about the need to sort of role play a character. I really struggle with that, and this doesn't have that at all. And I wonder if it works as a sort of almost a gateway game to get you into the mindset of how these games generally work, but then you can sort of start easing into some more character building elements. But there are also a lot more modern sort of games in that sort of OCR oeuvre. You've got your Mothership, OSR, as I mentioned.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Yeah. Mothership and other more modern takes on that genre that perhaps have taken off some of the more, should we say, dated tropes in some of these older games as well.
Yeah, definitely. Like, OSR is really like a vibe more than kind of a fixed definition. So if it feels right to you, it's that sort of like basic components and not too elaborate systems. It's sort of the vibe, and essentially like the lethality and the, you know, kind of having to just kind of go with the dice rolls and see what happens.
That's the point I was going to make, was in regards to the lethality, because I mean, obviously you have, you know, Souls-like games that are renowned for being punishing, but there it's all down to skill. When, you know, dying is pure luck, I can see that being, you know, bad game feel, right? And there's not much drama you can draw out of that. Your character is just dead.
Yeah, and I said that the supplements, like the different systems, Mutant Crawl Classics and X-Crawl Classics, are there, but really there's nothing stopping you from playing like a sci-fi game in DCC. Mm. In fact, they sell supplements that are like a bug hunt, sort of like Alien style, Mothership style, in DCC as well, like officially published material. There's things where you time travel, there's things where you fight robots in DCC supplements. So it's really freeform, freewheeling, very, very flexible. I think, yeah, board gamers in particular, who are coming from things like Pandemic or Descent, we played Second Edition, those kind of like adventure systems in a box sort of games, will really get a hoot out of this. I think it'll be not that difficult to transition, especially if you already have sort of like terrain from some of those board games already existing. Like, this will be very, very easy to transition into.
Yeah, we discussed this recently a bit in reviewing Dragon Quest III, the remaster, which has a similar sense of very old school. The characters are all just placeholders. The story is just a complete pretense to just go on an adventure and kill some monsters, right? It's just an excuse to get you into the dungeon and roll some dice. Yeah, so if that's what you need, sounds like a good option.
It's a popular genre for a reason. All right, so that's DCC, Dungeon Crawl Classics.
Excellent. Okay. So with that, I guess we should get to our dessert.
Oh yeah, I forgot we had a dessert segment.
Yes.
All right, what's your dessert little topic?
Treats. Yeah, so a couple of things I wanted to talk about that I've sort of wrapped up over the past couple of months. So today I'll talk about that I read through William Gibson's Sprawl trilogy. So this is basically what started the whole cyberpunk genre, ostensibly, with Neuromancer, Count Zero, and Mona Lisa Overdrive. It's a trilogy of novels. And I was reading these as part of the Shelved by Genre podcast, which I can highly recommend. It's basically a book club where they run through different sort of subgenres of speculative fiction. It's encouraged me to read some gaps in my sort of fantasy sci-fi that I hadn't gotten to in the past. So this has been fun to go through. It's interesting because you think cyberpunk, you often think of like VR and a lot of the virtual spaces, and there's very little of that here. Most of it is sort of referred to off page, really. There's very little actually in cyberpunk. I guess Snow Crash is the other big sort of cyberpunk novel that, that deals more with that side of things. This is a lot more to do with these sort of fuzzier concepts of AR and sort of the cultures that are springing up around technology and AI and faith. Yeah.
And sort of like post-nationalism too.
Yeah, I mean, there's...
transnationalism, I guess it's called.
Yeah, well, curiously, I think most of these novels were written in Vancouver. William Gibson was living here at the time and inspired partly by the huge Japanese influence in culture here. And I mean, I think you were mentioning recently about the sort of anxiety over Japan as a superpower in the 80s. And sort of that's infused a bit here too. And it's not particularly, like, there are some, definitely some cultural insensitivity issues here. There's a whole tribe of, like, space Rastafarians at one point, and not exactly dealt with a lot of tact. But it is incredibly apt, I think, and prescient in some of the ways that, that people interact with technology. A lot of it has, it feels very normal by today's standards, to be honest. And yeah, one thing is that I did find it incredibly hard to read. The prose is tricky. It's this mix of like technical jargon and sort of abstract poetic prose that it's, you can read through a page and not really have any idea what just happened. So you have to like read through it twice, and it's a tough books to get through, and the pacing is a bit off sometimes. So I didn't love them as a whole, but there are some incredibly cool concepts in there that feel pretty prescient today.
Yeah, lots of cyberpunk, the genre material is obviously ripped right off the page, the kind of the street samurais, the solo, the cyberware, the monofilament whips, things like that are just like right part and parcel, the razor girls, the rocker boys, that sort of stuff is right in there. And obviously very inspirational. I read those books years ago, but you're right, I kind of don't remember a lot that happened, except maybe some like communes living on the Golden Gate Bridge or something like that was part of it.
Oh, that might have been Johnny Mnemonic, I think.
Okay, there's the kind of Zurich space station or something like that in one of them. I'm thinking Neuromancer. There's a Neuromancer film coming out, or they say
Apple,
it's coming
out. An Apple series, I think.
Okay, right, there you go. So that's going to be a lot of material to come. Obviously, so much there, and William Gibson has written newer novels as well. I think the last one I read by him was Aidoru, the one about the kind of Japanese virtual pop star, of which actually exists now. So, not to mention VTubers and things like that. So,
interesting. I think I have that one lying around. I should grab that.
Yep, truth becomes fiction. So, if that's okay, I'm going to mention a book that I read as well. And it's also touching upon Japanese themes and is written a while ago in the 70s. And this one is called Shogun by James Clavell. This might be familiar to a lot of people because there was a, I think it was Hulu series, and it's on Disney Plus in Canada as well. I haven't watched the show, by the way. I wanted to read the books. It started a long time ago. This is a long book. It's like 1,000 pages long or something like that. And I just took a long break. I've read this over the past year or so, but not continually. I was worried that this would have, you know, kind of be, have a lot of those cultural insensitivities.
Yeah.
We talked about from other genre material. Obviously, it's a Westerner talking about Japanese subject matter.
In the 70s.
In the 70s. But this book is surprisingly well researched. And also, it's telling stories about a different place and a different time. So not only are the Japanese, the feudal Japanese, strange by modern tastes, modern perspective, also the things that the Europeans are doing at the time are really strange too. Like this book is a lot about, describes about a lot of what the Dutch are doing, about the Portuguese are doing, what the Spanish are doing, and what the British are doing, English are doing. And back in Europe, how their missionaries are acting in Asia and Japan. And basically, like, all of them are treated pretty, like, savagely. And the main character, his name is Blackthorn, or Anjin, which means what is Navigator or something like that. He is the point of view character, essentially. I was worried that this is going to be one of your kind of last samurai Pocahontas things where the white savior trope, the last of the Mohicans, where the white guy comes and teaches the savages how to live properly or something like that. And no, I was pleased to see that it's very much not like that. Really, like, he's kind of the savage and he's being kind of like civilized by the Japanese, or at least that's how it presents it a lot. Like, the main character says, like, I don't want to return to that kind of decrepit cesspool. Like, everything's clean here. Like, I take baths. Like, I took a bath once a year back in Europe or something like that. So I think also the way that the feudal Japanese act here would look very strange even to a modern day Japanese person, because obviously their society has moved on by quite a bit as well. So really, really fascinating. It also has a large cast of really interesting characters. Not only are the primary three characters deep and interesting themselves, but you regularly jump into the perspective of side characters. And that's interesting also because you get to see their perspectives. They sort of shine a light on different aspects of historical Japan as well, and kind of like the politics of it and things like that. So definitely well worth a read. Main thing that sort of bugged me about this is just kind of like something that might bug people that know Japanese already, is that the Japanese that they interject into this English novel is very informal and very modern. So they sort of, it sounds like, you know, you're telling a story about Elizabethan England, and it sounds like California surfer girls and boys talking. It's a little bit too soft, and they would be using different vocabulary and different tones entirely, which is much better handled on, you know, like a period drama, a Japanese produced one, for instance, like a samurai anime even. They'd be using a different formalized speech. But anyways, that's a small point. I think you're supposed to understand that the Western character is speaking broken Japanese when he speaks a little bit of Japanese too. So that's totally fine. The main thing I would say about this book is that it's long and it's hard to read as a result, but there's so much humor to it. There's so much interesting history. There's a lot of action, and not just sword stuff. There's naval stuff as well. There's land-based military kind of strategy. There's humor, there's sex, there's action all around. Really, really great book. I would just recommend the single volume is broken down into six sections within. I would just say, like, read one section at a time, give yourself a break, a breather, and then you'll get through it eventually and you'll feel good at the end of it all. So Shogun, the novel, still worth reading in 2025.
Interesting. Yeah, I started watching some of the TV show. I think we watched like two or three episodes, and we lost momentum with family visiting. We need to get back to that. But there were some really interesting explorations of like translation and both like deliberately misunderstanding people or translating things in different ways to sort of get your messaging across. Some really cool editing and how they do that. I'm not sure how accurate that was to the book. I was a little wary of the book, as you said, like, even with the best intentions and, you know, trying to be accurate and respectful, it's easy to miss a lot of the nuance in these other cultures that you're not living in as a lived experience. I know there was a TV show or a movie in like the 80s that was apparently pretty rough in terms of cultural representation. But the new Hulu TV show also filmed in Vancouver, largely, apparently. So
yeah, and I heard crossover. That it was also produced by Hiroyuki Sanada, who is the titular shogun in the show. So, you know, obviously he has a vested interest in presenting characters and history accurately. And you're right. The book actually treats translation like it's a kind of a main theme. It's like understanding each other, misunderstanding each other. And like that happens in a lot of ways, not only cross-culturally, but cross-religion. For instance, there are a lot of Christian Japanese in the plot of this. So the Christian Japanese treat the non-Christian Japanese differently as well. And that's a lot of the impact of it. The Christian Catholics, like the Portuguese and the Spanish, treat the Protestants, Dutch, and English are very different to each other as well. And so, for instance, the Shogun, when talking to his other generals, is talking about the different sects, the S-E-C-T-S, of Christianity, which you normally don't call Christian denomination sects in modern day English, but it's interesting to see it from their perspective, right? So I thought that was quite well handled.
Yeah, I definitely need to get back to that series at least soon.
Yeah, me too. I gotta get through it before I get to Japan. Anyways, lots of great content out there. We started out with a bummer, but I think there's actually, you know, really positive things out there. From my perspective, I'm just trying to play more of the games I already own and see more of the people I like and try and create more memories, more good times, and not worry too much about just being able to play it all or do it all.
Yeah, there's a lot that's, we've always been advocates for, you know, exploring older games and keeping them relevant. And, you know, even if we can't talk about the games that are in the current zeitgeist, we'll just create our own zeitgeist, I guess.
Yep, everything is old is new again, and most stuff is remakes or sequels anyways, right?
Excellent. Yep. Well, thanks for listening. Thank you, Mark. If you have any questions or comments on today's games, if you have any recommendations for a sci-fi sandbox exploration game, you can email us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
That's right. If you haven't watched us on YouTube yet, check us out there. Just like and subscribe and leave comments. Also, subscribe to us on your podcatcher if you don't listen to the audio regularly. Please tell a friend and leave comments. It means a lot to us. We don't monetize our show at all. We don't have ads. So, you know, we just do this for the love. We have expenses, but, you know, we just do our best with that and just are motivated by the feedback that you give and the interaction that you give.
Absolutely. And starting to line up some excellent guests over the next couple of months. So stay tuned for more information there.
Right. All right. You can catch me on Blue Sky at OmniGamer Mark.
And I am also at Blue Sky at Board Game Feast. And there's also the OmniGamers Club account there as well.
Awesome. All right. Well, another solid episode, our first back of the main sequence. And let's carry on with that. All right, Daniel. Good talking with you.
Thank you, Mark. And remember to have a balanced diet of games.
Bye.